All right, we played it last hour. We're going to play it again here because I want to give a little more feedback on the Jerry Kill comments about P.J. Fleck. This is on Sirius Radio with A.J. Hawk, and I forget the other guy. But let's listen in again. Then we'll go traffic and weather, and I want your reaction, and we'll give some strong points to you. But here is the former head coach, now athletic director, where? At Southern Illinois? I think it says Southern Illinois. Here he is, Country Jer.
Why doesn't he like you?
You know, it's the thing that, you know, when he got the job, you know, he's talking, you know, first of all, I had him for the first, he coached with me, but after that, you know, he changed a lot. I'll just be honest with you guys. I mean, people that have known him before, when he got with Shiano, and then it just, his personality changed a lot. And I knew his first wife, and he just changed a bunch. And then once he became a head coach, I mean, I helped him get the job at Western Michigan. And I just think sometimes ego gets carried away. And when he went into Minnesota and treated the people the way he treated my guys, and telling them they had to, he had to go in and completely change the culture, and there was a bad culture and bad people. You know, he made it sound like we didn't know what we were doing. And I took it personal. You just don't treat people that have been with you and helped your career, and you don't even talk to them, you know, once you get the job.
When he got the job and all that stuff happened, did you ever call him, or did you ever air it out with him?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't good.
No,
when's the last time
good.
You talked to him?
That's the last time.
So a few years then.
Yeah, and it will be the last time. Do I still root for the Gophers? I do. Do I enjoy him running up and down the sideline? No. Do I think that he's about the players? No. He's about himself. And you can't tell me you've watched him. You think you listen to his interview, you think he's for the talk, thinks about the players? I just lost a lot of respect. You know, it's kind of like when Jimbo Fisher left Florida State and went to A&M, and Trickett, who'd been with him for years and years and years, he never even gave him a call. And he just takes off and goes to A&M, doesn't call. I mean, those kind of things disappoint me in people. So I guess maybe disappointment is a better way to put PJ, and disappointed on how he handled some things.
Okay, on Fleck, first of all.
Let's get your chili hot.
Yeah. In fact, some are suggesting that's a guy we should get a hold of. Maybe we should get Coach Brew on today to give a reaction. What are you thinking about that?
I don't know. He could be busy today.
He could be busy today.
Depends how his mood is at 2:30.
Oh, trust me. I know that feeling, how his mood is. Okay. P.J. Fleck and all his phrases and expressions, is that what I want as a 53-year-old? And by the way, I was pretty much cynical like this when I was 12, okay? I learned at the foot, not of my father, okay? I learned at the foot of Patrick Royce, okay? So I learned to be bitter, cynical, and by the way, realistic and honest. Yeah. That's what I call it, realistic and honest, okay? Because the public persona of a lot of these folks and who they are behind the scenes, not always the same thing, okay? So Fleck in the phrasing and the row of the boat and all that, no, I'm not it. But as I've said 100 times, I'm not his demographic. Now, I'll say this again. There are good friends of mine in this town who will either write or say, well, you have to have a hook to win. BS. No, you don't. You don't. Okay? Kill didn't really have a hook, and Kill... We can have the debate on Kill and Mason. I lean Mason had more success here. I do, right? I also think, and it's moved up dramatically under Fleck, but the money that Mason had to pay his assistants was embarrassing. I mean, it just was, and the success he had. You know, now, Mason was hitting the same walls of late in the year, the other team would run for 7,000 yards. And when he faced the better teams, he wasn't winning. But what was Mason's hook? And by the way, if Glenn Mason was hired when he was hired here, could he win right now? Yeah, and there's no silly little thing about Glenn Mason. So, yeah, he can stand out that way. Running on the sidelines, not doesn't do a thing for me. But all the other things he does for 18 to 22-year-olds with some of the crowd, it absolutely works. It does. The recruiting, just stop. To all the apologists, and here's where most of your frauds, whoever the coach is, while he's here, you think he's the greatest ever. And whether it's in print, electronics, the Gopher Hole crowd, the recruiting analysts are some of the biggest frauds of all, too. Whenever a coach is here, they're great. As soon as they leave, they're backstabbing, right? Amongst the tops of the frauds. PJ has had the 8th best recruiting class in the Big Ten and the 10th best recruiting class. That's okay. There's nothing revolutionary about that. Now on a quill, on a kill. He needs to move on. And we've said this, and other people in this town who I especially respect have said this for a while. Now, PJ and when he'd say culture, that got to kill. And there's no doubt, and I've talked to multiple people who know Kill way better than me, and Kill has recounted the conversation to him. And then I know people who know Fleck, and Fleck has recounted. It was just Jerry MFing him endlessly. And Fleck basically just listening, and Kill just basically hanging up on him while he was just completely undressing him. Jerry felt underappreciated the entire time he was here. And Jerry Kill, I thought, was treated remarkably well here. Way, way, way beyond Jerry Kill and anything he did. As a father of a son who's an epileptic, Jerry Kill was battling that, just coming off other serious health issues. And this university stood behind him every single time. Gave him pay raises when, because of his health, you were uncertain about how much he could coach, gave him great leeway. And by the way, he was good while he was here. He wasn't great while he was here. Let's just be honest about that. He was good. But he's obsessed when every coach who hires now, Adam, you know this, we got to set our own culture. They all say it. That doesn't automatically mean the last culture was so awful that we have to change it. But we do have to remember, at the end of Clay's year, and by the way, the people say Clay's couldn't have won here. Where's your proof? Where's your proof? Because, again, it's, oh, he didn't have a hook. Okay. Many people succeed at other jobs, and not just at the Alabamas of the world, and they don't have the PJ hook. But Tracy's comment about, you know, defending the players while they were suspended. All right, Adam Carter, I think of you as a college football guru.
Oh, yeah. Mel Kiper, myself.
Yeah.
Well, I know. Lee Corso.
I know. Not so fast, my friends. I know where your uncle is because he's definitely on Team Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
There's no doubt. And he's mad at Philip John still. How do you take all this in?
I'm in your boat where I don't get the current coach's tactics, but I do understand that it works, and there have been some very cool moments also with PJ Fleck. What grinds my gears, if I can borrow that phrase, what grinds my gears
is Larry the Cable Guy?
I don't know. Is the online army of PJ Fleck,
yes,
like zombies, yes, who just the guy can do no wrong. And like you said it, so many of these people criticizing Jerry were rah-rah Jerry Kill is the savior until the next savior comes along.
98% of them who are now savaging
Kill
were saying Kill's the greatest. And by the way, 94% of them thought Brewster was the greatest ever.
Exactly.
So you're frauds.
Same people who were going nuts when sports writers had the audacity to question whether Jerry Kill still had the capability to remain as head coach when he was suffering his health problems.
Well, can we go to that one too?
Yeah.
Because again, this rings home a lot for me now because of Quinton, right? And watching those.
Yeah.
And I think of this now because hold on a second.
Well, la-dee-da.
We're lucky enough to get really good seats the first home game where Jerry had a seizure.
Yeah.
To the point where I grabbed Quinton and we walked away because he was curious and walked away. But it was horrible what was going on.
Right.
And I have no doubt when Jerry and his wife Rebecca, when they've talked about the many, many they had and concerned about his life. But by the way, to then have a conversation about because this job is so unique and so many hours and just taxing to have the question, can he do this? And the Army would be like, oh, you're so cold-hearted. Who are you to think about it? It's just an honest conversation about some jobs being different. And let's hope, and by the way, again, as the father of someone who has either a condition right now, the 35 people on the planet do, or right now he's the only one, I want Quentin to have endless opportunities. But I know certain jobs have certain challenges, and it doesn't fit for everybody. So I just wanted to jump
in. And those same people now are, you know, lining up, and you can't even criticize PJ Fleck in any form, otherwise you're totally against the program, and that's so tiring too.
And you're
so many walks of life, but
they're the leaders, though. The insecurity and the paranoia, Gopher football.
Oh yeah,
that group. You know no one is close.
Right. We're talking about the program, which you know you should be thankful for, considering the trophy case over there.
Yeah.
But that being said. Yeah, I don't get why Jerry – I mean, this is like something – you don't hear people criticize people that sharply in a public forum like that very often. And at this point –
But he's not to this level.
Yeah.
But when my guy El Duguay has interviewed him and others
– No, yeah, he slipped it there. But to hear it like this
– Yeah.
And I just don't get it at this point in time. Like you said, just move on. I mean, just last week he was – Named the
permanent
AD at Southern Illinois. So, yeah, I don't understand it.
Well, I mean, the wife one. Are you really?
Yeah,
you really want to go there, Jerry?
Pretty tacky.
I mean, that's classless. That is despicable, right? Again, I have no idea what happened with PJ Fleck and his wife and their marriage ending outside the fact they lost a child.
Yeah.
Okay, they literally lost a child. Right. And I've also heard him talk about how their two families now are so great together. I forget the previous wife's name, but PJ and Heather and how they interact together. So, I mean, are there people in Jerry's life who might have said who knew him personally that he's are we really going to go to that level on the, and he feels comfortable doing that? But I'll say this. The last 10 years of somebody who still knows a fair amount of people in the main organizations in this town, the two coaches who I've heard consistently are the biggest handfuls behind the scenes that belies their public image, in some order, Jerry Kill and Cheryl Reeve. And these are people I know very, very well. This isn't just kind of sort I'm hearing it from. No, these are people who I trust not 100%, not 1,000%, infinity. And both have very different images. But guess what? That doesn't mean they're awful people. It just means they're coaches who are very demanding, who want things done exactly their way, or else they feel underappreciated. And Kill and Reeve are both in that category. Okay, we're getting a bunch of text here. On Kill's comments, on Fleck, on the – because I think Jerry's being incredibly sensitive here. But, again, he still doesn't touch the Gopher football crowd. I mean, when – first of all, Patrick's been playing you like a fiddle, by the way.
Think that, oh, man, is this going to affect him in any way?
He doesn't care. One second. I love Beth. Hey, buy some tickets.
Yeah.
No, he's doing his job. We're doing our job. And – You know,
or I saw one today. At least you can run up the sideline. I'm like, you fatso. Like,
yeah.
Good Lord.
You really showed yourself there. Okay. Texts and phone calls on this one. Plain politics, including this nugget. The CNN reported in the last hour or so that the Mueller report might be delivered as soon as next week. That's coming up about 10, but more on Kill and Fleck when we return. All right. Among the texts coming in, we did get the axe back. Yeah, I mean, that was a good win for Kill. Right. For Fleck. How Fleck finished the year when apparently we fired the worst defensive coordinator ever, and then we hired Vince Lombardi, who rose from the grave.
Buddy Ryan.
Yeah, came up. But to his credit, finished well. Okay. This text. Kill lost me when he got caught paying North Carolina $1 million to cancel home-and-home series. Kill did go to Norwood. I don't remember if it was a million.
I thought it was like
750, I was thinking, for some reason.
800,000, that's what I thought.
I think you're right. I didn't agree with that one, but if we're going to eliminate all college coaches who try to cater the schedule to their benefit, then guess what? Every single one is gone. Everyone's gone. A text. Grind my gears. How old is that news guy sidekick?
Well, I'll tell you what, whippersnapper. Back in the day, back when Murray Warmath was coaching.
Yes. I thought you'd go Bernie Bierman.
Bernie Bierman.
Old guy, 35 years season tickets. Coach. No problem with Coyle won his own guy, but the way he handled the sex deal was a complete joke. This is the allegations of rape and assault and the university policy. By the way, what still bothers me most about that was the kids did not have representation when they first were meeting with the academic side. And Coyle and Kaler, in my view, Adam, regarding Clay's now, were throwing him under the bus on a regular basis. And if certain board or regents didn't step up. Now, did Tracy say the right thing? You know, I'll defend him anywhere. No, that wasn't the right time to say it. But I get what he meant. Jerry Kill's words about Fleck were not classy, even though he shouldn't have said it. He diminished himself. Like Jerry, but yeah, sour grapes and way too personal. I like PJ too, but his stick is a bit over the top at times. But he's making connections and looks like he may be able to elevate the program. Maybe. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe.
And you know what? I'll eat crow if that happens. Would I like to see the Gopher football program relevant and, you know, competing not only for Bills, but maybe something more? Absolutely.
Well, for me, you know me. Okay. Sadly, you know me. And it's a.
You want the story.
I want a story.
Yeah, me too. I have no real allegiance to the University
of Michigan. And I'm sick of this story. I'm sick. You know, and let's not forget, Mason had some good stretches, right? Kill had some good stretches. I want something to have solely so I can talk here. I literally am only a fan still of the Wolves because I worked there for 16 years. I don't care at all. I don't want anybody to lose. Okay, I was just at an event at Rosie's big retirement event, which was at Winter Park, and I saw seven or eight Viking people who I think are just great people, right? Just and I really like them. So for those individuals, I want them to have success. For me, I want more love boats. I want stuff to talk about, you know? And I don't blame people who are fans, but everybody doesn't have to be a fan. Fleck's first wife has praised his second wife for hopping on a plane every other weekend to pick up their kids and then reverse in the weekends. That's the worst part for me, without question, when Kill was going there. And he should rise up in that area alone and say, listen, I still stand by the professional stuff I said, but I shouldn't have delved in the personal part. Kill's comments certainly reflect poorly on himself. Yeah, and I'm going to back up everything Adam said before. I wonder all these folks here who are all over Kill, where they stood on Jerry when he was here. And by the way, you're allowed to react to new information, but this just can't be while he's here. He's amazing. And then as soon as he leaves, he's awful. And by the way, that includes many members of the media also. Because when all of a sudden I hear after somebody leaves, hey, let me start telling you that, that's journalism or broadcasting or print cowardice. If you know that at the time, say it at the time. Don't just be a butt kisser. Because you want to stay in somebody's good graces while they're here, and as soon as they get fired, you totally change because it's not too tough to figure out who those people are on a regular basis. And it's time for this partnership between WCCO Radio and the Star Tribune Editorial Board. We normally replay this right now. We're live here on WCCO Radio, but a lot of people are hearing it later, whether it's WCCORadio.com or StarTribune.com. Scott Gillespie from the Star Tribune Editorial Board joins us on the phone. John Rash in person. Gentlemen, Always a pleasure. Let's start, Scott, in the state, and then let's move nationally. Governor Walz, he unveils the budget yesterday. The Republicans, to the shock of no one, did not appreciate it. So I know I'm, as we're talking here live in the air, Governor Walz is with me in an hour. And part of what I'm going to approach him on, Scott, is when he was running, it was one Minnesota. It was, I'm going to try to find ways for us to come together. Did this budget unveiling look like an example of one Minnesota and coming together?
Well, that remains to be seen. The other thing he was running on was an agenda filled with just about every progressive promise you could make.
Yeah.
And he did touch all of those bases with this budget proposal. And, you know, it's he could have found ways to spend more money, but he would have had to work really hard at it. Now, the one Minnesota, how we come together, that's really up to him and the Senate Republicans to figure out.
What did you think, John?
I concur with Scott that it certainly reflected his campaign promises and the House Democratic majority here. If, of course, is an opening salvo. There will be negotiations. I think it shows how extraordinarily important that special election in the Minnesota Senate was, and now that they have a two-seat majority for the GOP, which should make Senate Majority Leader Gazelka much more comfortable in resisting particularly the gas tax, which I think is going to be the crux of how the rest of the legislative session plays out. I think Governor Walz has a very legitimate point when he says, this is not a surprise. This is what I ran on. I received more votes than anyone in the history of gubernatorial races in Minnesota.
All true.
And this is what we need to do to invest in our roads and bridges. The outcome isn't controversial, unlike some public policy debates that we've seen paralyze the Capitol here. Everyone in general recognizes the need to invest in infrastructure, roads, and bridges. It's how you get there and doing it via the gas tax versus the general budget. Now, of course, we'll know much more when a new revenue forecast is released next week, but I expect some long and tense hours at the Capitol, perhaps not with the personal acrimony that has characterized previous sessions, but with a lot of public policy difference.
So let me stay with you, John, then I'll get to you, Scott. On the gas tax, this was one of his signature items. There is no doubt about it. 20-cent increase tied to inflation increases. That's pretty dramatic. Do you think when they're talking behind the scenes, they think that's realistic? Or was that an opening salvo aware of negotiations about to begin?
My sense is a salvo in that they're going to have to dial this back. It will be phased in over at least 2 years, at least in how it was presented yesterday. But it is probably too steep for most lawmakers, including perhaps some rural DFLers, albeit there are fewer of them than there were in some previous sessions. But considering the number of miles that many of their constituents have to drive, that it may be a little bit harder for them to take here. But it is a really straight linear equation, at least politically, that those that drive need to pay for the roads, and this is the way that we fund roads and bridges here. But my sense is this will be part of the negotiations, but it won't be all of the negotiations. Mm-hmm. Governor Walz and the Democrats are going to have to bring something more substantial, I sense, to Senator Gazelka and his colleagues to be able to get them to buy off on any kind of increase in the gas tax.
Okay, Scott, do you sense at all that on the budget side, because there are other areas where I think they will come together, but on this budget, are we again looking at just a partisan divide and a party vote, and that we're down to the last couple of days and who knows, maybe a special session? Or is there a little bit of room? Is there anything different because Walz is in his first year?
Yeah, I think the personalities are different. The people are different. So that's critical. And we don't know. It's hard to predict. Some of the things we heard in reaction to the budget from the Republicans, we've heard before. For example, Senator Gazelka said that instead of spending more spending, we should be looking at state agencies for waste and fraud, and that could result in tax savings. We have been talking about looking for waste and fraud for, I think our lifetime.
Yeah.
And if it's there, great. Let's go grab that. But that's such a standard, tired line. It's also the one that we heard most recently from Republican gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson, and he lost.
Yeah. Picking up on that, John. Who isn't for it, right? If you're against that, I don't get it. Right. I just don't know how much money that really is. When we're talking about now a $49.5 billion budget, and I'm not scoffing if it's going to be any amount of money, but when we're talking about really trying to narrow the gap, how much money is it?
And certainly Governor Walz and any of his predecessors, if they were able to bridge these gaps, have the infrastructure investments by looking at waste and fraud, they would have done it and championed it and campaigned on it. And so certainly as the three of us agree, and I'm sure all of our listeners out there, everyone is for rooting that out of the system. But short of that, this system in terms of roads and bridges needs more investment. And this is the way that it probably is going to happen. And you also have this, certainly Senator Gazelka and his GOP colleagues in the Senate have a lot of power in this discussion. But you also have the flip side. If nothing happens, if they're not able to move forward on any kind of package to invest in this badly needed infrastructure, I think that could become a political liability as well. So it may be much more dandelions coming up in May than the continual snow we see here in February. But I think that they'll probably get there in some capacity.
All right, let's go to the federal level. Scott, this is from CNN in the last 20 minutes or so as we're talking right now on Wednesday afternoon. Attorney General Bill Barr is preparing to announce as early as next week the completion of Robert Mueller's Russia investigation with plans for Barr to submit to Congress as soon as he can after summary of Mueller's confidential report. The president was asked about it, and the president said this is totally up to Bill Barr what he's willing to make public. I've heard this analysis the other day, and I want to get both of you to react. Scott, you first, that we have such an enormous divide in this. And my sense is that neither side is going to be completely happy. That if you're expecting it's just going to be absolute, definitive, overwhelming proof that the president did collude or absolutely definitive proof that he did not, you're not going to see that. But are we just going to have our divide again about the things the president or his team did or the Mueller report believes they probably did or may have done or they've concluded that he did? And so then it's up to a subjective determination. Do you think it's going to be that way or will it be more definitive? And you might even see people on either side of the issue having a different view once this does come out.
I hope it's definitive. I don't know if it will be. Probably, if I had to bet today, would say that we'll still be stuck in our divide. People support the president still will not believe any evidence that there's collusion, even if it's produced by the Mueller report. And those who oppose him will see guilt. And that's what I'd bet on, but I'm not sure. I mean, this has been a very long, extensive investigation. We've seen numerous indictments, key people, lots of Mueller's gathered lots of evidence that we know about, but he's gathered a lot of evidence we don't know about, and talked to a lot of people who and we know some of what they said, but we don't know everything that they've said. So, remain open to seeing what's there. But, boy, we are awfully dug in this country right now.
What do you think, John?
Scott's quite right. We are awfully dug in. But you prefaced your question, Chad, by talking about neither side being happy. What should make most Americans happy is if this report is viewed as the closest approximation of the truth that any one man and any one process can get to. And certainly the credentials that Mr. Mueller brings to this and the way that seemingly he and his team have gone about it, particularly by not commenting on it publicly and going by the book, which is, you know, regardless of what you think of the president or his policies or his politics, Mr. Mueller has not entered that political fray in terms of going on the nightly cable news shows and, you know, talking about the process and where it stands at this point. This may be the first and only time during the entire process where we even hear him speak and report it. So, you know, regardless of where it ends, I think that it's been very, very good for the country that we've had this check and balance on such an open question. And finally, I would add that I think it's not just important but imperative that the report be made public and that the American people be allowed to know what this is all about or what it isn't all about here. And I think what will really upset a lot of people is if a portion or a significant part of it is kept away from the public under some national security reasons. Mm-hmm. I think right now there's so much that's out there that they should just let it out there and we can discuss it once it's been released.
Can I agree on that vehemently, because I'm concerned that we are going to have a fair amount of redaction or a fair amount of the report that's not released. And, you know, it, obviously as a journalist, I got to say, we really need that. We need all of it. And transparency here is really important. And that's, if we don't have it, that's really going to cause problems.
John, let's get to two of the major stories involving the president, which are tied to the Mueller report. Let's start with Andrew McCabe, first of all. Andrew McCabe became a punching bag for the president when the president was pointing out endlessly that Andrew McCabe's wife had lost a state race and had received money from Terry McAuliffe, a longtime friend of the Clintons. He forgets about the timing of that race, when it was, and any role Andrew McCabe had at the time with Hillary Clinton. McCabe, when he became the acting head of the FBI after James Comey was fired by the president, and the president said that was all on him, and he thought the Russia thing would be done. He's on record saying it was because of the Russia thing. McCabe writes about the conversations he had. He's talked about the conversations he had with Rod Rosenstein about potentially wearing a wire, concerns about what the president was saying, concerns about whether he was an agent of Russia and what should be done. McCabe eventually was fired just about a day and a half before he was about to get his pension. He also has come out in interviews, talked about when he went to the Gang of Eight. These are prominent people within the Senate and the House, the leaders and people in the Intelligence Committee, went to them and said that we are so concerned about this information about the president that we are conducting an investigation. I mean, this is with Mitch McConnell. This is with Paul Ryan. This is with Devin Nunes. These are Republicans. And he says, according to McCabe, that there was no pushback from any of those Republicans. By the way, as we talk now, there is silence from all those Republicans. Nobody's come out and said what Andrew McCabe said to me is not correct. I think all of that is very powerful. I saw him last night as he continues his media tour. And I want both of you guys to react on all this. The one thing where I was bothered by McCabe is McCabe said with Anderson Cooper that in his opinion, there's no doubt he was fired and that the inspector general report, which said he wasn't telling the truth about when he was a part of a process of leaking information about Hillary Clinton, that he thinks no doubt the inspector general was influenced by the Trump administration. That's an Obama appointee. And I saw a number of FBI people on the different networks who said, I'm a big backer, Andrew McCabe, but that inspector general in no way would have been influenced by the Trump administration or the president in particular. So, John, you first, then you, Scott. How do you take in everything about McCabe in this very busy week or so since all this came to light?
You put it in context of the conversation we were just having about the imperative of the Mueller report and the Mueller process in terms of fact-finding, in terms of multiple points of testimony, as opposed to one individual who may have a tremendous amount of veracity and a long and distinguished career at the FBI, but it comes down to what he is saying versus what some of the other people involved in the story are saying at this point. Who to believe often gets colored in terms of, you know, how you see the president, the investigation in this political era. So I think you also have the component of the differences between what Andrew McCabe and Rod Rosenstein are saying in terms of, you know, wearing a wire, as you say, that had been previously been reported by the New York Times and had been dismissed as a joke.
Yeah, he was
that he just threw, you know, tossed it aside at that point, and then talk on an extraordinary level of invoking the 25th Amendment.
Mm-hmm. County votes?
Absolutely, and try and remove the president at that point. So I think that what it points to is this incredibly volatile political era and the need to have as close approximation of the truth as possible in the Mueller report.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think that you're hearing and seeing Trump and Trump allies using everything that's come from McCabe, specifically the wire and the discussion of the 25th Amendment, to prove their story, their narrative, that there's a deep state coup, or there was at least a deep state coup underway. And so, you know, they're going on the offensive using it to some extent, and pretty effective for those who are inclined to support the president.
Let's switch now to the Times report, which came out about 24 hours ago at this time, about the role of the president himself in trying to affect inquiry, Scott, and their lead part was about with the Cohen investigation and the hush money payments for Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and then when the Southern District was involved, that reaching out to Jeffrey Berman, who had recused himself, was running the Southern District, but is a friend of Rudy Giuliani's, had been a Trump supporter, and because of that, he stepped away. And the Times is reporting that this is an example. It's not just this one, but this is another example where the president stepped in when he went to then-acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker and said, hey, can we get Berman back involved? Can Berman be in charge of this? And I've watched a lot of interesting conversations about this the last couple days where is this the president being naive? Is this the president thinking as he was as a New York City real estate guy where let's just get our people in? Or is this the president flat out demonstrating obstruction of justice? When you read that story yesterday and you look at all the things that the president has been accused of, and a lot of it, I believe, from credible reporting, let me say 100%, okay? How did you take this one in?
Well, I thought that was definitely the most significant piece of the Times long story, and I, you know, to some extent, took it as the president testing Matthew Whitaker, seeing what he had there, whether he could get him to do his bidding for him. I don't know what to make exactly of the fact that he didn't seem to understand that Berman had already recused himself from the investigation.
Yep.
Whether that was his just lack of understanding or if he thought somehow that he could get him to unrecuse himself, I don't know. But the power of that story really was in the bigger overall picture of how Trump, his administration, have waged both a public relations and a legal campaign to discredit Mueller, to explain the Flynn resignation as a firing, to go after all the investigations as part of labeling him as a deep state effort. And I thought it was a really interesting line in the story where the Times said that Trump's attempts to defang the investigations have been covered in the news media so much that many Americans have lost track of how unusual his behavior is.
Yep, you're right.
And I think that's true. There's so much here, and there's so much constantly coming at us that it's hard to see that bigger picture, that this is not usual, this is not typical.
Well, John, I'm just picking up on Scott's excellent point. I mean, we could one time just spin the calendar and pick a week from 17 or 18 and be reminded for 3 days that was the biggest controversy. And then we pick another month and it was that. These are happening all of the time. If any of these things would happen under most typical presidency, they would dominate the news for 3 months. And in this case, it happens and then you know something else 2 days later is going to rise to the point where you're like, really? You know, so in this Times report, jump in.
Well, it brings up the proverbial frog in the pan theory. And, of course, we all know this in terms of, you know, the long-held thought that, you know, if you throw a frog into a pot of boiling water, he's going to leap out. If you put him in there and slowly heat it up, he stays in. And I think the American public here is so used to the news churn and to this extraordinary era and to the clear attempts at obfuscation or politicization of this entire story by multiple sides here that they have become used to it, which I believe is to some degree part of the strategy in that, you know, it's hard to take apart one single thing. If you would have told the American public before this presidency began, all of these events are going to take place,
yep,
they would have thought long and hard about the how they were going to vote and how they were going to react if indeed President Trump did win the election. And so I think that I concur with Scott, that was the key takeaway in the story. And I think that Congress will have a whole lot to consider if and when they continue to look into this, including Mr. Whitaker himself,
yep,
according to the story, might be brought back before Congress because he had claimed that there were no attempts at any kind of interference from the President of the United States, and this story would suggest otherwise.
We'll end it right there. Scott, stay safe at home, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Scott Gillespie and John Rash, you also be safe. You made the treacherous walk. Luckily, we're only about a block. Well, not even a block apart. We're actually connected. So always appreciate it, John. Thanks so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
John Rash and Scott Gillespie, the Star Tribune editorial board. You can always check this out, or if you listen live to a podcast, you may have listened to it on WCCORadio.com, or you've listened to it on StarTribune.com. And we'll bring the same crew together once again next Wednesday, right around 1:35. Next hour. In the first half hour, we will get away from politics. We'll get to some other items. But as it turned out, we've been trying to get the governor on for a while. We tried to get him ideally on yesterday. But guess what? The budget and the media events afterwards did not work out. So the governor of the state, Tim Walz, with us at 2:35. You could ask the governor one question. What would that be? Text away. 81807.